I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The filibuster is back in the news with calls among Democrats to abolish or reform the procedural tactic so they can pass legislation on issues like voting rights with their slim majority in the U.S. Senate. President Biden, who has supported keeping the filibuster, said this to George Stephanopoulos last night.
I don't think you have to eliminate the filibuster. You have to do it what it used to be when I first got to the Senate and back in the old days when you used to be around there. And that is that a filibuster, you had to stand up and command the floor. And you had to keep talking alone. You couldn't call for, you know, no one could say, you know, quorum call. Once you stopped talking, you lost that and someone could move in and say, I move the question of. So you got to work for the filibuster.
Earlier in the day, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who used the filibuster to advantage the GOP when he was Majority Leader, issued this warning if the Democrats got rid of the filibuster.
Nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like. Everything that Democrat Senates did to Presidents Bush and Trump, everything the Republican Senate did to President Obama, would be child's play compared to the disaster that Democrats would create for their own priorities if they break the Senate.
Years ago, senators had to actually go to the chamber and talk to filibuster a vote on legislation. Today, all you have to do is declare your objection to a measure, forcing a supermajority of 60 senators to vote to break the filibuster, resulting in gridlock. Is it time to abolish the filibuster or can it be fixed? We have two guests who have joined us. Adam Gentleson is executive director of Battleborn Collective, author of Kill Switch, and former deputy chief of staff to former Senate and Majority Leader Harry Reid. Adam Gentleson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Norman Ornstein. He's emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of a book titled One Nation After Trump. Norman Ornstein, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. And I want to warn you that Adam and I are going to be talking for hour after hour. And the only way you can stop us is if 3/5 of your listeners vote.
All right. We are on guard for you there, Norman Ornstein. But let me just make sure our listeners can join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I do think, though, before we talk about what's happening today, we need to understand where this came from. And a quick history lesson, if I could turn to you, Adam Gentleson. In part, your book is about sort of where this filibuster came from. Going back to the framers, what was their vision of a functioning Senate?
Sure, yeah. And I think, you know, the most important thing for your listeners to understand is that in the beginning, there was no filibuster, not even the talking version that President Biden described, and I think that many people are familiar with. And there was a reason for this. The framers were very clear that they wanted the Senate to be a thoughtful, deliberative, even slow-moving counterweight to the House of Representatives. They wanted the Senate to represent the states, not the people. The Senate is, you know, has senators apportioned equally per state, whereas the House is apportioned by population. And they wanted senators to be elected to longer terms so they could have more time to sort of, you know, think through an issue and be less victim to the whims of political fads. But they also wanted the Senate to be a majority rule body that sought consensus, but when consensus could not be achieved, even after extensive efforts at deliberation, the majority was allowed to move the public business forward. The reason they were focused on this is that they had just had firsthand experience with the Articles of Confederation, you know, the first draft of American government. And the Articles of Confederation had a supermajority threshold in its version of Congress. This was put there on the idea that it would foster cooperation and consensus, but in effect, it fostered gridlock. And so the framers said, we're not going to do that again. We want to have multiple checks and balances in our system, a bicameral legislature, a judiciary, a president, but we want the decision points in the system to be majority rule. We want debate in the Senate to be thoughtful, but focused on the topic at hand, and we want to limit obstruction. So they also placed clear limits on debate in the Senate and made very clear that, you know, the purpose was to debate and be thoughtful, but to eventually have an up or down vote on the matter at hand and move on. This filibuster, as we know it as the talking filibuster, started to emerge towards the middle of the 19th century after all of the framers had passed away. Its principal innovator was Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, who was the leading representative in Congress of the slaveholding class. And while there were sort of other efforts at obstruction and other senators who toyed with the filibuster, Calhoun was its main driver, and he did so on behalf of protecting the minority interest that he represented, which was slaveholders, and obviously for the purpose of preserving slavery. Calhoun saw that left to its own devices, the majority of the country was likely to march towards abolition. The minority needed more power to block that progress, and so he sort of innovated this talking filibuster to empower it. Fast forward to the Jim Crow era, this is when the filibuster started to acquire the supermajority threshold that we associate it with it now, the ability to impose a higher requirement for bills to pass, from elevating it from a majority to what today is set at 60 votes. So up until the first half of the 20th century, the Senate remained majority rule as the framers intended. But in the Jim Crow era, also driven by the desire to block civil rights progress, Southern senators started to innovate the use of the supermajority threshold, but they only applied that supermajority threshold to civil rights. All other issues were able to pass or fail based on whether they could muster a majority vote. This was the time when, of course, we built post-war America. So everything that you associate with that era, except civil rights, was passed or failed based on whether it could secure a majority. Wow. As Norm has pointed out, these were hard-fought issues, but they were fought about whether they could get a majority. And then today what we've done is we've taken that supermajority threshold and started applying it to every issue, not just civil rights. And that's why you see the gridlock that has paralyzed our federal government.
What a concise description of 200 years of gridlock. I appreciate that, Adam. Norm, let me go to you. And the one of the intentions of the filibuster was to have debate and to bring compromise and to, you know, make the Senate this deliberative body. Did it have that consequence, or did it have the reversing consequence, which is it's the Senate has become a place where issues go to die or bills go to die because of the filibuster?
Sure. And, you know, Marty, one of the things we have to say is there really weren't all that many times in history when the Senate was a great deliberative body. There have rarely been these dramatic and great debates. But we had more of them in the past. And the reality is, the blunt reality, as Adam has pointed out, is that under the current set of rules as they exist, and in particular with the 60-vote threshold, not a present voting standard, but an absolute standard for senators, the minority had no reason to do anything that would require debate on their part or any kind of heavy lifting. So we've actually moved away from debate and deliberation because of the way in which Mitch McConnell has used the filibuster and the idea that the rule itself pushes us in that direction is really not true. What pushed us in the direction of having broader bipartisan compromise was norms in the Senate that said both parties understand that there's a set of problems that need to be fixed in the country, and even if we have different views about them, we should try and work together and find ways to compromise or horse trade to help to solve those problems. That's no longer the case, and I would argue that it's no longer the case, first, because we don't share that common set of facts or set of problems, and because we have a party that is not so interested in solving problems. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me pick up on that to you, Norm, and even going back under the Biden administration when Mitch McConnell famously said, you know, we want to make him a one-term president. Didn't work out that way. But nonetheless, was he saying we're going to essentially just stop all legislation coming from the Obama administration?
Yeah, and it was it even goes back, frankly, to the first 2 years of Bill Clinton's administration, a minority party strategy of uniting as a parliamentary style minority, voting against everything and blocking what you could and delegitimizing what you couldn't. And remember that after Mitch McConnell made the statement that his number one goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president, he sat down with reporters and in quite a bit of candor said, well, of course we weren't going to cooperate with the administration. This was after this big victory that they gained from the obstruction in the 2010 midterms. We weren't going to cooperate with them because if we had, good things would happen. They would get credit. It would look to be bipartisan. And so we weren't going to cooperate even when there was a crying national need to do so. That's a new kind of approach that has continued into, as we saw with the COVID relief package, the Biden administration.
I mean, Adam, can we say then the Republican Party just knows how to use the filibuster in kind of crass political terms?
Yes. And I mean, as Norm is pointing out, you know, McConnell's leadership was a watershed moment. No leader prior to him had ever used it as extensively as he did. And I think one of his further insights was not just that the minority party gains by blocking big pieces of legislation that the majority wants to pass. The minority party also gains by creating an overall sense of gridlock in Washington, in particular against a president like President Obama, who had sort of campaigned on promises to fix the broken politics in Washington. And, you know, whether you agree with that strategy or not, I certainly don't. You can't argue that it didn't work. I mean, it did work. And the problem that we face as a nation is that everybody saw that it worked. And so even if Senate Republicans replace Senator McConnell as leader, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. You know, it is in their rational political interests. I'm not making a value judgment here, but I'm saying right. that if they want to get themselves back in power, and if they want, and they do so by making the majority look bad, they will pursue the same strategy because McConnell showed that it works. And that is why we need reform to allow the majority party to actually get things done, because you cannot rely on the minority party at this point to operate in good faith because their political interests pull them very strongly towards obstruction.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, but just picking up on that, and Adam, just quickly, Mitch McConnell talking yesterday saying basically, well, if you do this and we become the majority, we meaning the Republicans, we'll have abortion restrictions, we'll harden the border, we'll defund Planned Parenthood, that they'll sort of do their revenge on the Democrats when they become the majority party again.
Yes, and I think that's, you know, there are risks involved here. There's no easy answers to these tough problems that we face as a nation. But one thing I would point to is I think that it's actually a lot harder to get majorities to pass these things than you would think. Republicans campaigned for 7 years on the idea of repealing Obamacare. When they finally had the chance to do so in 2017, when they controlled all three branches of elective government, they were unable to get a majority to do so. They didn't fail to repeal Obamacare because of the filibuster. They tried to repeal it through reconciliation, which allowed them to do so on a simple majority, but they were unable to get a simple majority to do so. So I think, you know, passing policies that are very unpopular is a hard thing for politicians to do. And the type of policies McConnell is describing are very unpopular.
Well, we are talking about the filibuster, whether it should be done away with, whether it can be reformed. That's Adam Gentleson, also with us, Norman Ornstein. And you can join us. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Much more after this short break, and we'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the filibuster, which has had a long, checkered, and controversial history. Today we're talking about how the Senate rule has been used and abused over the years, the pros and cons of ending it. We will get to that, ideas for reforming it, get to that as well. And again, our guests are Adam Gentleson, author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Norman Ornstein is Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Let me play a clip from Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois. This was on Monday, calling for the elimination of the filibuster. This was a speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
In 1975, the rules were changed again. requiring just three-fifths majority, 60 votes, not 67, but 60 votes to end a filibuster. Suddenly, the filibuster became relatively painless, for senators at least, and the number of filibusters exploded. From 1917 to 1970, the Senate took 49 votes to break filibusters. 49 votes in that period of 53 years. That's fewer than one a year. Since 2010, it has taken the Senate on average more than 80 votes a year to end filibusters. Filibusters of so-called motions to proceed now regularly prevent us from even discussing proposals supported by the strong majority of American people. The modern filibuster has broken the normal legislative process. It was never an essential or even intentional part of democracy, and now it rules the Senate.
Do you agree, Norman Ornstein?
Yes, I do. And the skyrocketing numbers are proof of what's happened. The one thing I would add to this, Marty, is, and it's often misunderstood, and I've seen this in story after story in the last few weeks, which is the rules change went from two-thirds to three-fifths, which makes it sound as if they made it easier to stop filibusters. The key point is they went from two-thirds of those present and voting to three-fifths of the entire Senate. So imagine if they'd gone to three-fifths of those present and voting. Then the Senate could go round the clock 24/7, and if 20 members didn't show up because the minority was finally exhausted, you would only need 48 votes to end debate and move to action. Now you need 60, and the burden is entirely on the majority. And that's why we've seen these increases, because Mitch McConnell saw, as he busted the norms, that if you lifted your little finger barely, you could bring an issue to a halt or for a long time nominations and soak up a lot of the precious floor time in the Senate. That's a key point here, moving from a present and voting standard to an absolute number.
Well, and Adam, picking up on that and going from a talking filibuster to, as Norm just described, someone just lifting their fingers so that one member of the U.S. Senate can essentially halt debate, vote on a piece of legislation. Do I have that right?
That's right. And the great irony of this is that by raising that little finger, what that member is actually doing, that senator, is claiming the right to continue debating the bill. You know, when we talk about the 60-vote hurdle, what we're talking about is the vote to end debate on a bill. It's called the cloture vote. It was often referred to as the closure vote. Think of it as bringing closure to a debate. So anytime a bill comes to the floor in the Senate, it has to go through this period of debate. There's no way to get around it. The bill has to pass through it like a tunnel. And the only way to get through that tunnel and to end that debate period is to have this 60-vote cloture vote to end debate. The vote to actually pass the bill is still at a majority threshold in the Senate rules. It's just that most bills can't get there, because to get there, you have to clear this 60-vote hurdle to end the debate period. And, you know, the irony of this is that no one's actually debating. So when senators, you know, this rule is in place because it's supposed to be sort of a reflection of the Senate's tradition of debate and the idea that, unlike in the House, the minority will always have a chance to discuss at length any issue that it chooses and try to persuade the public to come over to its side. But senators have, you know, in the decades since the 70s, senators have realized that they don't actually need to go to the floor to have this debate. They can simply claim the right to continue debate. And doing so is more powerful than a talking filibuster, because instead of just delaying the bill for a while they make their case, they've actually increased the number of votes it takes to pass the bill, which is a far more powerful legislative tool. And in our polarized era, today in a Senate that's divided 50-50, you would need 10 Republicans to come over and help you clear that hurdle. That's simply not going to happen. So the filibuster is much more easy to use than it's ever been, but it's also much more powerful, because instead of just delaying a bill while you give a speech, you can increase the number of votes it takes to pass a bill to a hurdle that is nearly impossible to clear.
Well, Norm, you have a fix, and I'm quoting here. This you wrote actually before the election. It was last fall. I believe it was in The Atlantic. You say instead of 60 votes required to end debate, the procedure should require 40 votes to continue it. If at any time the minority cannot muster 40 votes, debate ends, cloture is invoked, and the bill can be passed by votes of a simple majority. Flesh that out for us.
So if we flip the numbers, you put the burden back on the minority. They have to be there, and if at any single moment they can't get to 40, or I would actually make it 41, then you end debate right there and you move on to action. I actually, worked this through years ago, talking to Al Franken, who early on in his Senate career said to a Republican colleague, "See you on Monday." And the colleague said, "No, I won't be there on Monday. There's a cloture vote. I don't have to be there. You do." Underscoring the point that the burden was entirely on the majority. So thinking of ways that we could change that burden, it made sense to me to flip the numbers. And, partly, Marty, this is a pragmatic thing. If we're dealing with a Senate where we're not going to get 50 votes to completely change the threshold down to 50 or 51, as they've done now with nominations and confirmations, what could we do that puts the burden back on the minority? And I would pair this with the idea that Jeff Merkley has had for a number of years of the talking filibuster. You have to keep on the floor and you have to debate the issue that's at hand germanely, meaning you can't, as Ted Cruz did once, quote or read from Green Eggs and Ham. You actually have to talk about the issue. Get a national spotlight on an issue and you're going to see some changes. Let me give you one example.
Sure.
The House has just passed a universal background check for guns. 94% of Americans approve of that and believe it ought to happen. Bring it to the Senate now, and it won't get any attention because the assumption is not going anywhere. It's not going to pass muster because you don't have 60 votes for it. Force them to go round the clock to continually come up with 41 votes to block something that 94% of Americans want. Have to debate it where you're going to make clear that this is the 6% represented by the NRA and the gun manufacturers, and at some point they're going to break.
I mean, Adam, bringing back the talking filibuster, would that bring the kind of debate that we need in this country?
I think there's a possibility that it would. I mean, I think that if you look back to previous eras, part of the reason that people used the filibuster a lot less was that it was really hard to use. It took a lot of effort to go to the floor and hold the floor, as Norm is describing, for an extended period of time. If you wanted to do it, one person can only hold the floor for so long. And so if you wanted to actually delay it more than a day, you had to put in the effort to coordinate with your colleagues and have a rotation, and make sure that you were not leaving any gaps that the majority could jump in and bring an end to debate. So it took a lot of effort. And the other thing it did, as Norm alluded to, was it brought public scrutiny. And if you were blocking a bill that was very popular and supported by an overwhelming majority of Americans, like, say, the American Rescue Plan that Congress just passed and President Biden just signed into law, maybe you didn't want to be in a harsh, bright public spotlight expressing your unpopular opinion. I think, the ability to express an unpopular opinion should always be there. It's part of our American tradition and is certainly part of why the Senate exists. But the public could see and judge and listen to your opinions and decide that they agreed or disagreed with you. So this combination of, the political cost of holding up a popular bill that was supported by a majority of Americans and the sort of simple nuts and bolts effort required were part of the reason that the filibuster was not used nearly as much in past eras. So I think, putting those burdens back on the minority could go a long way to alleviating some of the obstruction that we see.
And we are talking about the filibuster. That's Adam Gentleson. He's executive director of Battleborn Collective, author of Kill Switch, Norman Ornstein, emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump. I do want to play one more clip, which I think speaks to what we were just talking about. And this is clip number three. This is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. He was on Fox News on Sunday with Chris Wallace discussing his opposition to eliminating the filibuster. Let's give it a quick listen.
I'd make it harder to get rid of the filibuster. I'm supporting the filibuster. I'm going to continue to support the filibuster. I think it defines who we are as a Senate. I'll make it harder to get rid of it, but it should be painful if you want to use it. You should make sure the place works to where, okay, I want to work with you. How can we do this? How do we move forward? My Republican friends are my friends. They're not my enemies. And my Democrats is my colleagues. They're not my enemy either. That's my caucus. Together, we've got to make this place work, and it should be harder to invoke pain. It should be painful for us. Don't make it painful for the other side.
Norm, the Senate has so many rules, but would it be possible if the Democrats could get Joe Manchin and Sinema and some others on board that in order to reform the filibuster, change the filibuster, it would be filibustered, and so we would never get to that change?
So we now know that there's a way around that, and it's been used twice, once by Harry Reid after it was clear that Mitch McConnell would not allow a single vote on a nominee for the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, the second most important court in America, no matter how well qualified, that by a majority with I'll describe it in a second, you could alter the rules. And at the same time, it was used again by Mitch McConnell for Supreme Court nominations. And fundamentally what happens is you get a ruling by the chair, what the rule is. You get an appeal of the ruling of the chair, and under Senate rules, a majority can prevail with that appeal. So now we are still in the first legislative day. It's like it's the beginning of the new Congress in theory. Motions to change the rules can be done under this procedure. So, yes, it could be done by a majority. But you need 50 votes. And that means you need to get Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, Dianne Feinstein, and others who don't want to completely abolish the 60-vote hurdle or the filibuster itself, but who are open to changes. And in a different interview, Joe Manchin actually talked about the 41 as opposed to the 60. So I think we're on track to seeing some significant changes within a matter of months.
Interesting. Do you share that perspective, Adam? And then I want to read it, but we've got a lot of people that want to weigh in, and I do want to read some of our comments, but go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I listen, you know, Norm's worked on this for many years. I've worked on it for some years. And, you know, we are farther ahead on the path to reform sitting here having this conversation today than I expected we would be. I think part of it is that Republicans have made the case for reformers. You know, by not participating, by doing nothing but obstructing President Biden from the very beginning, even delaying, you know, the organizing resolution, which is sort of the basic thing the Senate has to pass just to, you know, work its day-to-day business. You know, McConnell threatened to filibuster that at the very beginning. You saw zero Republicans in either House of Congress vote for the American Rescue Plan, which is desperately needed, backed by 75% of the American people, and reflects a consensus view of economists and health experts for what's needed to combat the pandemic. So Republicans are sort of, you know, not giving Democrats any reason to believe that they're going to be willing to participate or cooperate. And that's driven Democrats to think, well, that we have to find a way to get things done because we're facing major challenges as a country. And I think that's led us quickly into this conversation about reform. So I do think we're headed in that direction.
That's fascinating. Let me read some comments. One from Ben. He says, Republicans stole the Supreme Court. Why shouldn't the Democrats take control of the Senate? Email from Roy. Over the first half of the 20th century, the only thing the filibuster was used for was to stop civil rights legislation, as we talked about earlier. It has a racist history behind it. It was used recently by McConnell to block judicial nominees to the lower courts, which is why the Democrats removed it for that. An email from Dick. How about instead of asking McConnell for a real discussion about bipartisanship, or does he admit that his goal is total obstructionism? We talked about that as well. Here's a comment from Thomas. The idea that the filibuster makes it impossible to govern is false. Plenty of bipartisan legislation has passed in the last few years. The filibuster only makes it hard to pass partisan legislation. Norm, can you speak to that? That there is a place for the filibuster, and there has been bipartisanship in the past.
Well, there has been bipartisanship in the past, and it's going to be interesting now to see, Marty, whether this very credible threat of dramatically changing the filibuster shakes up Republicans enough that 10 or more will come along for some of the significant things that are on our agenda. Here's another example. Let's say that Democrats bring up the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And keep in mind that prior to the Shelby County Supreme Court decision. The Voting Rights Act amendments, the last ones, passed unanimously in one body and nearly unanimously in another. Bring that up, hold some hearings on it, allow Republican participation and some amendments, as Joe Manchin has called for, and then see if 10 or more will support something like that. And if that doesn't happen, you have all reason to believe that there will not be any bipartisan cooperation, even under this threat, and you can bring about a change. We're going to have some real live examples to see whether we have bipartisanship. Now, does it make some sense to have some way for a minority to that believes intensely to at least delay for a period of time action by the Senate to put a public focus and spotlight on their concerns and see if the American people will rally behind him? I'm fine with that. In fact, mm-hmm. I think it would be a pretty useful thing. But the way it's used now is a complete distortion of that.
Well, Adam, picking up on that and about a minute before our second break here, what then is the role for a minority, either party or a minority opinion, when it comes to debating legislation? Do they have a place at the table?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's what the framers intended. And, you know, Madison clearly intended for the minority to have a role in the process, to have input, as Senator Manchin has called for, and to have a voice. The difference is that obstructionists have shaped the filibuster to give the minority not a voice in the process, but a veto. And that was what Calhoun did. He explicitly stated that he did not think Madison's system gave sufficient power to the minority, and he explicitly stated that his goal was to turn that voice into a veto. So I agree with Norm that the minority should absolutely have a guaranteed voice in the process. That's what the Senate should provide. But at the end of the day, they should not be allowed to have a veto over the process that creates the kind of gridlock we've seen. That veto is what has brought our government to a grinding halt and prevented progress on pragmatic bipartisan solutions that exist and that could pass tomorrow if we had a more functioning system.
We are talking about the filibuster, and that's Adam Gentleson, author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Norman Ornstein is with us as well, emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump. We have much more to talk about after this very short break and more comments and questions as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about the filibuster, where it came from and how it has been used and abused over the years. Let me play one more clip, and this is President Obama. He was at the funeral of former Representative John Lewis. This was back in the summer of 2020, calling for the elimination of the Senate filibuster to expand voting rights. Let's give it a quick listen.
And if all this takes eliminating the filibuster, another Jim Crow relic, in order to secure the God-given rights of every American, then that's what we should do.
Norm, anything you want to say in response to what President Obama was just saying there?
This was, of course, in the context of voting rights, and it speaks to the history of the use of the filibuster. As Adam said right at the beginning, more than anything in a major way to try and block civil rights and voting rights over the centuries. And that's a critical element now because we've seen more than 250 bills and amendments in states that are rank voter suppression, that are aimed at restricting voting rights, especially for people of color. And without some change and change in the filibuster rule, we may get a very different world than the one we have been living in. And I would add one other element to this that's an important point, I think, Marty. We already have enormous power for minorities in this country. In the Senate, before very long, 70% of Americans will live in just 15 of our 50 states. That means 30% of Americans will elect 70 senators, and they don't represent the diversity or the economic dynamism in the country. Right now, with 50 senators, Democrats represent 41 million more people than do Republicans who have the same number of senators. So the minority is heavily overrepresented by the nature of our political system. And what we have now is, I would say, a Republican Party. If you look at what's happening in states from Arizona to Florida to Georgia to North Carolina to Iowa, is an effort to preserve power with a dwindling share of the votes. That can create a crisis of legitimacy in the system. And it's another important reason why we have to make sure that the rules work to protect the right to vote.
Adam, I've got a caller, Robert, that has some questions, and I'll make sure that the question is put to you. Robert, go ahead. Sure. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hi, Marty. Yeah, it's likely that Democrats will be ready soon to restore the talking filibuster because both Joe Manchin and Joe Biden support that, while they don't yet support the filibuster rules elimination. So once the talking filibuster is restored, what piece of legislation would it be best for Democrats to force the Republicans to engage in a weeks-long talking filibuster against, which would resonate with the most voters and be the most costly for Republicans to block? Now, Norm mentioned the gun purchase background check bill. I like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, because a filibuster against that would echo the anti-civil rights filibusters of Senate history, with Republicans playing the role of the old white supremacist Southerners, and it would fuel grassroots protest, especially among African Americans, against the filibuster as it drags on. And Barack Obama might get actively involved in opposing a filibuster against the John Lewis Voting Act, and of course the Biden administration would too.
Robert, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Adam, what piece of legislation do you think the Democrats should put out there to see how it plays?
I agree that the John Lewis Voting Rights Act should be the one. To some extent, I think sort of whatever works, whatever gets you to the reform. But I think that the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is also the most likely to be that piece of legislation that forces reform, for the reasons the caller outlined. I think that there's an enormous amount of poetic justice to the fact that it would be a civil rights bill that is the thing to lead to this major reform of the filibuster. And I also agree, sort of as we've discussed today, that part of the use of the filibuster is to place a spotlight on the people who are opposing a given bill. And, if they can make their case persuasively and convince the public that they're right, then that's part of what the Senate exists to allow them to do. But if they are, giving speeches explaining why it should be easier to deny people the right to vote, and the public decides that they don't like that and want to vote these people out of office, then, that's a potential risk for them to take. And I think the voting rights bill, the polling we've seen shows that, like the American Recovery Plan, voting rights bill polls in the stratosphere. It is supported by a broad bipartisan majority of Americans. So if Republicans want to spend days, weeks at a time making the case against voting rights, I welcome them to do so. And we'll see how that plays out.
I mean, Marty, go ahead, Norm. Go ahead.
I just want to say that I'm a little skeptical that the talking filibuster alone will do the trick, because there's still going to be a heavy burden on the majority if you don't change the numbers. If you just have to talk, they've got 50 people, they can divide it up an hour at a time. And it's a burden, but it's not the overwhelming one. And you're still going to need, if they don't change the other part of the rule, 60 votes. And you're going to block action on everything else, major priorities along the way, including all of these confirmations that are critical to the Biden administration. So what I want to do is marry the talking filibuster with a change in the numbers, either move to a present and voting standard itself, or to my preference, the 41 required to continue debate, so that the burden falls much more heavily on the minority. That combination would be more potent than just the talking filibuster alone.
Let me read a question from Russ. He says, since the Senate has an anti-majoritarian structure that significantly favors the Republicans, isn't there an inherent danger in making it easier to pass extreme right-wing legislation through the Senate if the filibuster is eliminated? Adam, what do you say to that?
Yes, I mean, that is a very good point. I have a couple things that I would point out in response. One is the only way you're ever going to be able to fix that dramatic tilt that favors essentially, you know, white conservatives in terms of representation over everybody else. The only way you're ever going to be able to fix that tilt to the right is by eliminating the filibuster so that you can pass measures like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that would make Republicans who come from very diverse states, particularly in the Sun Belt, more accountable to the entire population that they represent, so that, you know, black populations in those states are not sort of systematically denied the right to vote. And the only way you're going to pass things that change the structural representational aspects of the Senate is by eliminating the filibuster to pass things like statehood for the District of Columbia or Puerto Rico if it decides it wants it. You know, you have the state of Wyoming, which has about 600,000 people that are almost exclusively white population. That Wyoming gets two senators. Then you have the District of Columbia, which has about the same size population, even a little larger, and its population is predominantly black and brown, but it gets zero senators. So the way to fix this structural bias is to get rid of the filibuster so you can pass the types of reforms that will fix it.
Norm, you're a longtime observer of Congress. Do we have a dysfunctional government? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, we do. We have a very dysfunctional government. And, you know, the fact is, if we had a government operating on all cylinders, we have enormous and daunting challenges in dealing not just with this pandemic and what might happen in the future, with the challenges of a global economy, with an element that undergirds an awful lot of what we see in our government now, which is the racial divide, which is a major contributing factor to our political tribalism. All of those things would be difficult to deal with even if everything worked well. But it becomes really urgent for us to make some changes because we have a government that can't work right now. And if it works, it works in a halting fashion. It's taking the elements of the system that were supposed to slow things down and make sure that you could build with debate and deliberation towards a broader consensus in this huge country. And it's taken it to a dangerous extreme.
Well, and picking up on that, and Adam, let me toss this back to you. As we know, Congress just passed the $1.9 trillion rescue package signed by President Biden. I mean, some would say, well, look, you know, look, Congress was able to do this. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, and the reason it was able to do that was because that package was able to pass through a special process called budget reconciliation, which, again, you know, not grand Senate tradition. This is something that was invented in the 1970s and further developed in the 1980s. Reconciliation is a useful pathway for certain kinds of legislation, but it is very restrictive in terms of what is able to go through this pathway. And, you know, the basic rule of thumb is that most legislation cannot go through this pathway. For instance, Democrats tried to attach an increase in the minimum wage to this reconciliation bill, to the COVID aid package, and that was struck down by the Senate parliamentarian. You know, the person, there's one person who determines what complies with this process, and it is the Senate parliamentarian, and their decision is sort of treated as final, although, you know, you could argue it shouldn't be, but that's a separate debate. But the point is, this process was able to be used for the COVID aid package, but won't be able to be used for most other categories of legislation. But I think it's instructive because I think that Democrats had the experience that they haven't had any time in recent history of passing a major piece of legislation on a majority vote basis. And I think they kind of liked it. This is a popular piece of legislation. They're able to deliver concrete results to people. And I think they're seeing the benefits of doing things through this process. So even though this particular process won't be able to apply to other pieces of legislation, it might make Democrats more inclined to say, well, you know what? If Republicans are going to block us, we should just pass the things that America needs on a majority vote basis and let the people decide if they like it or not.
Do you think Manchin would do that? Senator Manchin would do that, or Senator Sinema?
Well, I think reform is going to be a long iterative process. It often tends to be this way. You know, I think what Norm has proposed of a talking filibuster combined with shifting the numbers to 41 to sustain and a president voting standard would be a very powerful reform. And perhaps that is enough to start getting things passed. So, you know, Senator Manchin has indicated an openness to that suite of proposals. And I think hope that we will head in that direction, hopefully relatively soon. But I think ultimately the guiding principle behind reform has to be, do we allow our government to function again? You know, the purpose of the Senate is not to preserve its rules in amber. It's to produce thoughtful policy solutions to the challenges we face as a nation. And I think that needs to be the guiding principle through this reform process. Are we once again able to pass thoughtful, pragmatic solutions to the challenges we face? If the answer is yes, we can stay there. If the answer is no, we might need to keep going.
I mean, if people are paying attention, we have learned a lot about how our government either works or doesn't work or is supposed to work in the last couple of years. But how do you get to be the parliamentarian, you know, the person who decides whether something gets a reconciliation vote or whether, you know, how the rules apply? How do you get that job?
So, can sometimes be a partisan matter. We've had parliamentarians fired by majority leaders who didn't like what was happening. But in general, you get people who work up through the ranks in the office of the parliamentarian. They learn the rules and the precedents. They are almost always enormously impressive and honest people. And that's what we have right now in the Senate parliamentarian. But as, you know, Adam said, and I think it should be underscored, you really don't want to be in a position where you have to do all kinds of gymnastics to make something happen under an arcane procedure that is the only way in which you can get to a majority. Sure. The power shouldn't be in the hands of a parliamentarian, no matter how much integrity and expertise exists there.
Adam, here's an interesting question or comment from Thomas, who says, given that the entire government is stopped by a filibuster, shouldn't the House be able to vote on stopping a filibuster? Raising an interesting question about this balance of power. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the House would certainly say yes. The Senate would probably say no.
They'd be salivating over that, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. And, members of the House, think that this existence of the filibuster is completely inexplicable. And an interesting fact is that the Senate and the House basically used to have the same rules. And there were certain things that were made different about them by the Constitution, like the existence of the Speaker, which is a position that is enumerated in the Constitution, whereas the Senate leaders were not. The position of majority leader in the Senate didn't even exist until the 1920s. But the Constitution is very clear that the two houses are not supposed to be able to do anything to sort of govern the other. They're supposed to be independent bodies that provide a check against each other. So, I think it would probably take a constitutional amendment to allow one house to pass a law that binds the other in any way. I think it depends on who you ask, but it's probably not something that is feasible in the near future, for better or for worse.
Yeah, for better or for worse. Norm, what do you think?
I agree with Adam entirely.
So do you think a year from now, if we get you back on the show, we will be talking about a different kind of filibuster, Norman Ornstein?
Yes, I do. I think we're going to have some changes in this process. It's not going to be perfect. We're still going to see delays. Mitch McConnell has said that he will go to DEFCON 1. I think we should not take that at face value. The majority has plenty of ways of retaliating on that front. We're going to have, if we have filibusters on these key issues, some will be broken and some will not. It's going to take up a lot of time and effort, but it's going to be a better place. And I think we're going to see a Senate that will be jolted into functioning in a better fashion with rules changes. When they happen, I'm not sure, but it will happen.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us on Radio Times to talk about this important issue. Norman Ornstein, thanks for coming back.
Oh, absolutely, Marty, anytime.
And he is Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump. Adam Gentleson, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It was really a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Executive Director of Battleborne Collective, author of Kill Switch, former Deputy Chief of Staff to former Senator and former Majority Leader Harry Reid. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And if you want to download a podcast of the show, you can do it wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.